Halfway home on a Monday. Ben and Woods, 97.3 The Fan. First of all, I want to apologize to Sammy Levitt for, well, playing him off because we ran out of time. And Paulie was giving me the wrap-up, and I'm like, bro, he's on a roll. I'm not Ben where I can just go and just plow through. I just let him finish. If he runs out of time, he runs out of time. You know, like I don't know what to tell him. But then people were in the chat. I'm like, why is everyone being mean about Sammy? And they were like, Sammy has a lisp, but he doesn't have a lisp. Not that there's anything wrong with having a lisp, but he doesn't have a lisp.
No, he doesn't.
But he then texted you and said, why did Zoom give me a lisp? Did you put him on some...
I didn't do anything.
So good. Sammy Levitt joins us this
The moment, rise to the occasion, show grit, show fight. They have certainly given you all of that. And
it really did. Yeah, somebody said it sounded like he had a retainer in.
Yeah. Working on some Invisalign. He's like, what happened? I go, I don't know. I thought you had a retainer in, honestly.
Tyler said, Paulie activated the brace face filter. Yeah, it makes you sound different. Well, we are very honored this morning to be joined by one of my dear friends, one of my favorite people in the world, the great Tim Flannery joins the program. Morning, Flan.
Good morning, everybody.
How are you?
I'm really good. You know, we had a night at the Belly Up last night, and I played the last three songs. So I every day game, I would walk in the clubhouse and say, why is everybody up in the middle of the night?
Right.
That's kind of how I feel at the moment.
And that's when you played and coached, right? Like, you just, the day game for a baseball player, not your favorite.
Yeah, it was always great once you got there and got working and got, but you know, you get on your schedule, you get in the grind of the 162 games and, but it's just part of it. It's part of who can sustain all the things that happen over a season because the season's so long. And how long is it, you might think, even though I did 25 years in the big leagues and, you know, managing at every level in the minor leagues. But my last year, I didn't even know that my nephew got his wife pregnant in spring training, and she had a baby before the World Series was over. The season's so long, you could carry a baby, a human, in your body. And that's when I said, I'm going home and I'm going surfing.
This is exactly why I wanted to bring Flan in this morning to chop it up. We got a chance to chance to get to know you over the last couple of years, and certainly at fantasy camp got to spend some time together and hang out. But you know, being able to coach your grandson Jesse was so, when I found out that Jesse was on my squad, I was like, oh my god, Tim Flannery is going to be at my games. He's going to be watching me coach, which is very intimidating.
You're a great coach.
Thank you very much. And Flan pulled me aside. He goes, I don't know how you do this. And I said, I don't either. And you said, when we get to the real deal, where there's outs and, you know, strikes and balls, you give me a call and we'll work with them. And you'll get the fungos going, get them on their knees, picking the grounders and stuff. Because that's the stuff I'm really looking forward to.
I couldn't believe how great they got and how much they improved. And that's totally a credit to you. And I manage at every level in the minor leagues. I manage the Padres Rookie League when all the All-Americans come to you, you know, in June. And we always said you got the three P's. You got to be persistent, you got to be patient, you got to be positive. And you were that and you are that. So thank you for... because I don't ever want to put pressure on. Look, I never played catch with my father. My father was
right?
A Christian minister, a hillbilly minister out of the mountains of Kentucky. My mother's brother is Hal Smith, who played for the World Series in 1960, Pittsburgh Pirates. And he was a songwriter. So I always thought that everybody played baseball and
guitar.
Wrote songs.
Yeah, right.
I didn't think there was anything bad about it, you know? So the baseball and the music really came from my mother's side.
And so I got a chance to meet your mom and see her. And she is how old again?
92
years old, was at this birthday party. And her brother was Hal Smith. He played for the Pirates, as you mentioned. So the World Series against the Yankees, everyone remembers Mazeroski. But Hal Smith did what?
Well, the Yankees were killing, and when they won those games, when they won three of the games against the Pirates, it was like 13-1 and 12-0, and when the Pirates would win, it'd be 2-1, 3-2, and in Game 7, down by two runs, my uncle pinched hit, in the eighth inning, hit a three-run bomb that put the Pirates ahead. And then the Yankees, that next innings, tied the game, and then Mazeroski won it the next inning. So we had the reel-to-reel big films of the Pirates, and I just always loved it and was always just a baseball guy that loved it. They say I used to sit and watch games when I was 2 years old, and I probably did.
Yeah, 100%. And we talk a lot about it because as a dad of a player that is absolutely on fire for the game, you know, you do worry about the burnout and this and that, and you kind of said the same thing. You said, no, I was the same way. I never could get enough. Everyone said you would burn out, and here you are still. You're still not burned out.
Well,
on baseball.
The neighbors used to tell my mom, you know, that he's going to burn out. He's going to burn out. And they were right. You know, about 2015, I had enough after 50 years.
50 years, right. All right. Well, Bo can make another 50 years. I'm pretty happy. Joined by Tim Flannery in studio this morning. Flann was telling me at this party, and again, we got to edit part of this story. But there was a tell me about the strike in baseball, when you went through the strike, and just listen to how different it is now than it was then.
I cannot wait for this.
This is fascinating.
Well, I went through four of them.
Four.
And the two of them were over 50 days. And I'm going to start on the other side and then work back to the strike.
For context, the most recent strike, how long was that? That was...
The lockout?
That was like 90 days?
90 days, something like that.
But that's how I coached. You know, I would say... I can remember I was in charge of all the bunting in San Francisco. And 45 minutes a day, I'd have the pitchers, and I would bunt them and hit and run and slash. And we were the best in the league. They got signs, because we worked on it 45 minutes every day. But some days, like I can remember Matt Cain said, I'm not going to do it. I go, and I grabbed him by the uniform. I go, I went on four strikes so you can make $1 billion. So you come and save my job.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's how, but the story you like, and it is an honest to God truth. This is before cell phones. 1981, we went on a 50-day strike. And it didn't seem like it was going to end at all. And I was living in Del Mar in a little beach house for $400 a month. My wife at the time was not my wife. She was in Europe and we were going to get married. Anyway, I was on a surf trip and I was down in Mexico when the strike settled, but nobody could get a hold of me and I didn't know. So, I was surfing every day, playing beach volleyball every day. I mean, I was in fighting shape. And when I finally did get back a couple days later, everybody's getting on a scale and guys are like 20 pounds overweight. You know, I was 5 pounds underweight.
But you've been down in Mexico doing tequila shots, surfing all day. But think about that for a minute. So you go on strike. And to think, like, what, how, you know me, Paulie.
Yeah.
You know me. We go on strike. And I'm just like, all right, get me later. Like, there's no way. I would have been calling someone every day. We close. You just said, I'm going surfing. And how did you know to come back? You didn't. You just happened to come back.
When the surf trip ended, we came back. And when I got to the border, and, you know, and of course, we're surfers. They had to take our car apart. Oh, they've got to have drugs if they're surfing.
Well, they've been down there for 2 months or whatever.
And then they were telling me, hey, the strike's... I go, what? So we got to, you know, we went right to the ballpark.
How
late were you to, like, reporting?
Two days. 2 days. Okay.
But the funny thing about the whole thing was, not funny really at that time, but I got sent to AAA, and I'm thinking, this is great. You know, and I was making big league minimum, which was $32,000.
Good God.
And this was 1981, and the Padres called me up. They knew there was going to be a 50-day strike. They didn't know it was going to be a 50-day strike, but they knew it was going to be a work stoppage. And to save money, that's where the money was these days. It was $32,000. They didn't want to pay it.
That's unbelievable.
But it did. God. You got your big league time. You got 50 days more big league time. You know, I had 10 years when a final was over. I was a player that got 10 years in the big leagues and a coach that 15 years in the big league. So I had 25 years. So, you know, it all worked out. It was just, you know, the game was different. The city was different. Everything here, it's been amazing to watch it just become, you know, what it is and all the people that the Seidlers and all the folks that had a lot to do with it. So grateful. You know, San Diego, when we first came to the big leagues, in my 10 years, I played for 7 different managers in 10 years, like 3 different front offices. So it was so hard to find any continuity, it really, until Dick Williams came in and put this club together, and the organization started got on the map, got rolling, and it's great to been a part of some of that early success.
Well, and it's great to have you back in the fold with the San Diego Padres for us. You know, certainly when we heard you were going to be at camp, I was so elated, and the stories that we got to hear from 84. Second to none. Ben moderated the whole thing. It was incredible. Some of the best baseball stories I've ever heard.
I hope you enjoyed Fantasy Camp, because I need you back there every year now.
Both of you guys played really well. So I am at Fantasy Camp.
Yes.
So,
boom.
During the tryout section, I tell all the good players, fake injuries.
Yeah.
You know, we'll still draft you. You're number one, but we need you to not to get drafted by somebody else.
It's been great to see you back in the fold. You know, I've been in town for 14, almost 15 years, and there was a time when it didn't feel like you were, and now that you are, it's great. I mean, and honestly, like, bygones are bygones, and you're back doing stuff with the team. And of course, you still have a huge piece of your heart in San Francisco. You got 3 rings there with the San Francisco Giants. Nobody begrudges you that, but it's just great to have you back around the San Diego Padres.
I love it. You know, it reminds me of who I am, and what really happens. You know, people think that, you know, we just left San Diego. That's not the case. Just because you're with the San Diego Padres, we had different ownerships. We had different front offices. And Sandy Alderson would send a little computer readout every day down to Boats to who's supposed to play that night.
Is that right?
And Boats would tell the guy that walked in with, you know, he's like 4 feet with glasses.
The gopher.
Boat says, you take that up to whoever gave it to me and tell him to shove it. I mean, so Boat, when he was leaving, and think about that. The guy won 2 division titles and they let him walk.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll hear Boat fired me in 2002, and I needed to be fired because I don't pretend well. And we got the ballpark passed in 98 by winning. We had to win to get the ballpark passed with the voting. And then all the lawsuits kept it from happening. So we just had to hang with them, you know, and we were told develop a couple guys, but it's not going to be pretty. Well, I'm not your guy if you're pretending. And he got unhealthy for me, you know. And so Boats, you know, said, hey, you got to go. But
it's awful.
And then in 2007, I'm walking my dog, and I get this phone call from Boats, and he goes, you got another ride left in you? He goes, they're trying to win up there. And then he sent me the video of Lonesome Dove about the 2 pig farmers retired at home kicking the pigs. And that's where he got me. I said,
done.
Yeah. And my wife goes, you're going again, aren't you? I go, I got to go one more time.
Oh,
did you
man.
Think when you were fired in 02, you said, did you think that was it? You were done?
Yeah, but I started with that salary at 32, right? 1,000, and I played 10 years, and I always played on a 1-year contract until my last couple years. And so you're playing for your life. And anybody that played in the 80s, even if you made money, you know, I mean, you can't retire on the money that was made then.
Yeah.
So I had to eat, and I was raising kids. So I being the song and dance man, I took my music to another level. But I also started getting in down here with the radio and the TV and learning this business. And this has been over the years, you know, when I went up to San Francisco afterwards, I did 5 years of TV and then 3 years with MLB Network. So it all works out, I guess, is what they say. And but I am so honored to be able to come back to the Fantasy League. And Peter Seidler, him and I connected. And I really didn't connect over baseball with Peter. I connect over his work with the homeless.
Sure.
And I wanted to find, is there anything I can do? You know, I hit 9 home runs in the 80s. I can't just write a check, you know. And Peter took me, and we were sitting in opening day, and he together, and he would ask me questions about the guys, and I'd ask him questions about how to help, you know. So that was that, how that developed, and then I got invited, you know, to the fantasy league. I love it.
It's awesome.
I love it.
That's awesome.
It's great to be a part of it.
We got Tim Flannery here. Let's take a quick break. We'll come right back. I want to get some thoughts that you had. You shared with me about Jackson Merrill, one of your favorite Padres, who is going to be an all-star as a rookie, which is just spectacular. Talk about some of the guys that you've helped bring up in this great game of baseball. We'll be right back. It's Ben and Woods on 97.3 The Fan. Welcome back to Ben and Woods, 97.3 The Fan. An honor to have the great Tim Flannery join us for a couple hours. And, man, the stories, we're getting off the air. Just phenomenal. I mean, it's like, yeah, this is so
good.
That's
for another time.
Those are for a podcast. Ben is out today. He'll be back tomorrow. But, yeah, I wanted to just talk to a man who I love very much and is a very soulful guy. And I appreciate that when it comes to the game of baseball, you know, they're different types of people that you meet and players that you meet. And Flan is, you're all heart and soul, my friend. And I know that you brought a lot of that into the teams that you played for and then the teams that you coached. And, you know, the hardest thing about, I would imagine, from your perspective, is all the different personalities in one room. It's just got to be insane to try to manage that. And not only manage that together, travel together, be together, then and also win together is just impossible, and that's what a good coaching staff does. And I know you are a huge part of the Giants' successes over the years, and you and Boach and the rest of your crew. But how difficult is that when you get 25, 26 guys trying to all do the same thing?
Well, I think Boach was just a genius at it because the way he treats people, and he also remembered how hard the game is to play because it looks so easy from a distance. And everybody out there, including myself, as soon as we got out of the game, we became better. It's a very difficult game. And think about it, right?
Yeah, man.
And that's one of the problems. It's, and as a third base coach every night and hearing all the fans over 15 years, you know, it's why I'm a little calloused and I don't bruise easily, because every night I was getting screamed at, and people who don't know anything about it would tell you how to do it. But we also had the teams that win, and this team down here in San Diego, this team, not, I didn't care for the other one, even though all the hype, because that's not how you win, you know. This club is playing together. And Carlos Santana, not the catcher, the great guitar player, he's in the dugout with like 2 weeks left in the season. About a month left in the season. And he's got a Giant uniform on with Santana on the back. And I go out for my early bunting, and there's Carlos Santana. I know who he is. And we just chit-chat. And then he says, you know why you guys win? You bring your collective intangibles. The things that can't be quantified.
Sure.
Those types of things. And then he says, I'll see you again, and we'll celebrate in the rain. A month later.
Good God.
A month later against the Cardinals, it's pouring down rain in October in San Francisco, and Marco Scudero catches that ball in the rain. Oh. And I still get chills going, oh, that's why he has a record called Supernatural.
That's wild, man. Wild. Yeah, the intangibles, I like that. And you start to think about the little intangibles that this team has, Jerickson Profar being one of them. Absolutely. The smile that, but he's also a stone cold killer. He's such an irritant now. He was getting under the Rangers broadcaster skin. Why? Because he ran too slow around the bases, right? He's got one leg. He's running around. And listen, he's got 10 years in the game.
Yeah.
Knows the game. Has seen it all in the game. Is having the best season of his life. Let that man enjoy himself a little bit, because he certainly has earned it as well.
Yeah, and you know what? If you look at the teams in San Francisco that won, and you look at what was happening up there, is guys like Profar, people that they would trade for, maybe a veteran who'd been around but never won before, and when they come over, they see what it's all about when you start winning and profars like that, and what he's doing this year has been fantastic. And how do you, anybody that shows up every day mentally, physically, spiritually, and ready to play the game, it's not easy. 162 games in 180 days, it's real easy to make excuses. Not today. But Profar, sometimes you have to go through all that you go through to get to a point where you're playing for everything, playing for all the marbles, and he's that way. And as far as Merrill, I'm just going to tell a quick story. I came to the big leagues when I was 21 years old, too, and it isn't easy because all of a sudden you're facing the guys that you might have posters on your room that you grew up with, and now they're on the mound, and you got to go through all of that. And even though in the minor leagues I was runner-up for every batting title, you know, and they started pounding me in, and I couldn't make that adjustment. And I even knew it was coming, and I didn't know how to get to there because I was more up the middle the other way and in the gaps. For Merrill to come up here, and I watched it because they started pounding him in. We always used to say that the National League's, we call it the hands league because that's where they're throwing the balls on your hands. And then you got to split the plate. You can't cover, maybe Tony could do it, but not many people can cover, and I could do it up through AAA. You can't cover the whole plate. You got to look away and be able to take in, or you got to look in at, like I had to do, and cheat a little bit to get to that fastball in and take the off speed pitch or take the ball away. And you make those adjustments as you go. He's done it remarkably, and the way he plays, the way he handles himself, those are the guys. Those are the guys that are going to bring you amazing memories when his career's over. You're going to look back, and he's the reason I turn television on every night and watch him.
No kidding. Yeah, he's definitely up there for us, too, and in our family. Bo loves him, obviously.
Right. This is Jackson Merrill.
Hi, Jackson. Jackson's now going to pretend. What a moment. And even, you know, even what he said after was, yeah, I mean, all right, we lost the game. I'm pretty pissed. I love that. I mean, you love that. Even if it's BS, I don't even care if it's BS. He's allowed to be proud. He's allowed to be excited. He should be excited and proud of himself. But he knows the job's not done yet. The thing I love the most, the adjustments you talk about, because you said, oh, they started pounding me in. So I started cheating. I started cheating a little bit. Well, then once you start to cheat, what do they do to you? They mix it up on you again.
Then you go the other way. But that was, I like that out there. Yeah. You know? And you have to go through all of that. The adjustments to stay in the big leagues. And I managed, like I said, at every level. I even managed in the big leagues for a day and got the victory. And that's a whole other good story.
Want to know, baby.
I'll tell you
that. All right, I want that one, too.
But in AAA, when I was managing, almost everybody had amazing moments in the big leagues in AAA. Joe Charbonneau was Rookie of the Year, and then the next year he's back in AAA.
Yeah.
Because you can't make adjustments. This is a game of adjustments, and they'll find out in 15 minutes, and everybody will be coming at you until you make that adjustment. What he's done has been really remarkable at his age.
Take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Flan. Obviously, we want to talk some Tony Gwynn. You played with Tony. You talk about his acumen. I would like, personally, for fans to stop comparing any... Well, not comparing, but saying, like, well, Tony Gwynn could do it. Because you played with him. You saw him, how he worked. He's a unicorn. He's absolutely one in a billion, absolutely, right? So I want to talk about the work that he put in, how he did it, some great Tony Gwynn stories, and more coming up next with Tim Flannery here on The Fan. Welcome back, Ben and Woods. 97.3 The Fan. Very special guest in studio this morning. The great Tim Flannery joins us, telling all kinds of baseball stories. We will get right back to them after we do a quick check of traffic. I joined live in studio by Tim Flannery, former Padre, second baseman, shortstop, utility man. Wherever they needed you, Flan, you would play. You would hit anywhere. You didn't care. Just wanted to be in the lineup every day, which is such a different mentality than guys like I have. Don't hit it here. Do not. Please let me have to sacrifice bunt because I'm afraid to hit. Right? I was always that guy. But no, I mean, some of the guys that you played with, obviously legends of the game. We heard the panel at Fantasy Camp talking about the 84 team, and it was staggering. Some of the stories. Goose Gossage, lunatic. Straight up, lunatic. Gary Templeton.
You're a nerd, too.
Yeah. Yeah, old Goose telling Ben he's a nerd was amazing.
We made the mistake of putting Goose on live radio.
We did.
Yeah, that was a mistake.
And then Ben, there was a huge, huge.
And then Ben started needling him about analytics in today's game.
Oh, I bet he loved that.
He lost it.
That's the drop.
You're a nerd, too.
Yeah, called him a nerd. Straight up.
Right to his face.
Right to his face. Pointed at him.
You're a nerd, too.
Yeah, Ben's like, oh, man, I just thought I would. Now I'm a nerd. It was great. It was great.
When they brought Nettles and Goose over right before the season in 1984, we watched them walk in the clubhouse at Jack Murphy, Qualcomm, whatever it's called, was called. And we all looked at each other, and it was such a positive. It was like the front office. They just saved us. This is the time. This
they
is
care.
Our time. And they were such a huge part of, and Nettles being a guy that I loved with New York, he was living in North County. I would drive every day to and back for the ballpark. He would take me with him and Goose out on the road at nighttime after games.
Oh,
and,
my God.
I'll never forget. It was like 2:30 in the morning in New York City, and we come up an alley. They're taking me to Studio 54, and we get out, and it's pitch black in the middle of the night, and there's a line, and one guy they just said, "Mr. Gossage, Mr. Nettles, come on in."
Unreal.
He taught us a lot, and the stories that you were talking about earlier of Peavy and Trevor came to that fantasy camp to be around that crew, be around our 84 crew. And I heard Peavy telling Trevor, "Hoffy, you got to get in here and listen to their stories. These guys, they fought the fans. They were in the stands fighting the fans. They fought other teams. They beat each other up." And then I'd always say, "Yeah, but Goose and I would go to blows sometimes." And then when I'm going out to hit, he'd be there cheering for me, and then we would be out that night. It was just a different time, and thank God there wasn't social media.
Oh, you would have been toast. I mean, I think about it all the time. I think about those old crazy-ass Yankee teams out every single night. Now, you know, it's one thing, too. Like, obviously, me as a Padres fan now, there's a part of me that's glad that I don't see my favorite guys out at Studio 54 at 3 o'clock in the morning, because then I'm like, all right. And then, you know, the next day you go 1-for-4, strike out three times. It's like, well, no wonder. There's so much information now. Back then, ball players were a bit of a mystery, and you could get away with a lot more.
Yes, you sure could. Yeah. And even before that, I hear stories that my uncle told me about Mickey Mantle. He played with Mickey Mantle. And during the trains, when they were traveling on trains, you know?
Yeah.
I tell you, we'd talk like the old coaches in San Francisco, because we were the old coaches.
Right.
And Wotus would go, "I tell you, back in the day when we took the train." So the train's ready to leave, and Mickey shows up right when the train's leaving, about 1-2 in the morning, and he had a couple girls with him, and they said, "Mick, you know the rules. There's no women on these trains." And Mickey goes, "Okay, good luck in Cleveland then."
Oh my God!
And they okay, Mick, come on.
Oh my God! Good luck in Cleveland.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's so good. But if that came out about my favorite player now, right, I would hate it. It would
absolutely
be a huge scandal. We'd be wearing it on Twitter and everything else. But oh my God, what a different, what a bygone era. Let's talk about Tony Gwynn, somebody that you played with, and you know, obviously he's one of those guys where every day, if you're on social media or whatever, you always see, whether it's Instagram, whether it's Twitter, doesn't matter where it is, you see some thing pop up, and it's Tony Gwynn's face, and it's Tony Gwynn only struck out 3 times in 14 years or something against this pitcher. And every day there's this new stat that I see, and I went, it just blows my mind. I know how hard hitting is. I have no idea how hard it is to hit at that level, and against the pitchers that he did it against and the pitchers that you did it against. But my God, did he make it look easy.
He worked at it. He worked at it harder than anybody. And, of course, the story, and it's true that he brought the video in. He brought the first-time videos were in. And I'll tell you, to this day, he's probably the only guy that knows what they're looking for when they're looking at the video instead of just staring at it with, you know, glazed-over eyes.
Because you're supposed to now.
Yeah. Right. He knew exactly what he was doing. And he, even if he had four hits the night before, he had an early hitting every day at 4 o'clock. And it was just, you know, and selfishly, my best year when I got to play every day, I was a utility guy, you know, and but when I did play every day a couple of years, I had my best years because I led off and Tony hit second. And when the count would go 1-0, I'd see the manager sprint to the mound. I knew exactly what he was saying. Don't walk this guy. Tony's coming up. So I'd get a pitch to hit. But it, just the way he, and you know, he was my locker mate next to me. And you know that game you always played before the season against San Diego State, the last game after spring training? Tony, when he was at San Diego State, went 5-for-5 off of our big league pitchers.
It's unreal.
And I remember Dick Williams said, that kid over there, I don't know, but I'm just telling you, when he gets to the big leagues, he's never going to be taken out of the lineup ever. And then Tony came up and I had 10 years sitting next to him in a locker, and I turned him on to his bat, his B267, 33 and a half inches, 32 ounces that I used. It was a B267, a nice barrel. And Tony used that his whole career as well.
Here comes this kid, and you know, you'd seen him a little bit. Obviously, you'd heard about him and knew what he was capable of. And he's your locker mate. You got 10 years in the big leagues. It's very similar to what's going on right now, I think, in the Petco Park. Jackson Merrill, Jerickson Profar did an in-game interview yesterday, which I hate, by the way, in the middle of the inning. And he's great. He did a fantastic job. But he's talking about a 21-year-old coming in, moving guys around defensively. He just started playing center field. And Profar is saying on the interview, now he's moving us, he's positioning us, and he's taking charge. And, bro, this kid's unbelievable. Was that some of the vibe that you got with Tony? Was he a vocal guy when he got there, or was he just kind of quiet?
He was quiet. And
lead by example.
He led by example. He was willing, wanted to learn everything he could learn. But we all, just the way he handled himself as a professional, as a man, it was one of the greatest. To be able to play with him for 10 years and then coach him for another seven. I was a coach on the team. Nobody coached Tony.
Tony, get your hands up a little bit right?
But it was just remarkable to watch some. And it's like that thing in Cincinnati when I was coaching. I've told the story more than once. I did it on MLB Network.
I saw that. It was amazing. Tell it again.
We were playing the Reds, and we had rain delays all night. And then about 11:45, they brought out a lefty. There was two guys on, and who knows what inning it was. But they brought in a lefty to face Tony, and then the heavens opened up and just poured. So they suspended the game till the next day, which means you got to play the same lineup. That pitcher hadn't thrown any pitches. He just warmed up. He's got to start the game the next day.
Yep.
So on the way up, now it's like midnight. We'd been there all night with rain delays, and I'm walking with Tony up the stairway in old Cincinnati riverfront. He goes, "Flan, tomorrow this guy's going to throw me a first pitch slider, and I'm going to hit it in that left center field gap, and both runs are going to score. It's going to be 2-2. Be ready." And I, you know, I'm thinking, after we've been there 14 hours as coaches, I go, okay, whatever, Tony. Sure enough, the next day, first pitch slider. He knew what the guy was going to throw him before the guy on the mound knew. And that's what Pete Rose could tell you, and Tony could do the same. He could look at a calendar and say, okay, in 3 weeks we're playing the Pittsburgh Pirates, and this guy will be starting, and these are the pitches he's going to. They're just geniuses, and they're all in on it.
It's why it makes me insane, because of the comparison. They compare Luis Arraez. He's one of the more similar guys to. That doesn't make me mad at all, because he does have that ability, you know, bat to ball, good quick hands, can hit the ball. Tony had a little more pop than Luis does. Probably better base runner, but definitely a better defensive player.
Tony made himself a defender.
Yeah, but you watch it. But for me, it's like, well, Tony Gwynn can do it. Tony Gwynn used to do it all the time, and it's like, bro, you got to leave him out of any modern conversations because there's just nobody that does it like that.
Absolutely. And for as long as he did.
And Nolan Ryan's another one. Nolan Ryan did this. And I'm like, he's a freak. He's a unicorn. He worked his ass off, but he was also one of a billion. You know what I mean?
I faced Nolan Ryan 71 times, more than any pitcher I've ever faced. I faced him 71
times.
You
had success, didn't you?
Enough to be fed to him the next time he pitched. You know, I mean, this guy was... I had some good moments against Nolan, but... nobody would play. I could watch it. If it was like 2 days before there was a catcher up in San Francisco and Timmy Lincecum comes throwing a bullpen. So I kind of got back and so I wanted to see what Timmy was throwing and what it looked like.
You got in there.
And I'm walking away and the catcher goes, "Hey, Flan, did you ever face any nasty guys like Timmy?" I go, "Yeah, I faced Nolan Ryan 71 times." He goes, "Well, how come?" I go, "Well, I played 10 years in the big leagues and everybody would get sick. They'd get this virus called Ryanitis." And to this day, that kid still thinks that there's a real virus going.
Of course he does.
He's looking for a vaccine for it.
So Ryan's on the bump the next day. All of a sudden, my knee's a little swollen. My back's a little stiff.
It would start if he's pitching on Sunday, on Friday. You'd hear guys coughing. You know, and I knew that I'm a left-handed hitter. I got to do it. And then when I was leading off, Nolan, my last couple of years, he would get gets the ball and the game's about to start. He's rubbing the ball and he walks down and he's playing like he's checking the grass right by the plate and he's looking right at you like, "You better not bunt." And so after about the third or fourth time he did, I just looked at him. I said, "Hey, Mr. Ryan, I ain't going to bunt.
I'm not bunting." Speaking of grass, it's not that grass. You told me a story because, obviously being a part of three championship teams with the Giants, and you had some characters. You were just talking about Timmy Lincecum. You had Buster Posey. But one of the biggest characters, literally and figuratively, it was Pablo Sandoval.
Absolutely.
I mean, a guy that could absolutely rake, a portlier fellow, mm-hmm. Not really fleet of foot, but could pick it, had a good arm, the whole thing. And you were tell me about that story, what you had the groundskeepers do out in San Francisco.
Well, first of all, the thing I liked about San Francisco, you'd see the best outfielders' arms, and they would be blowing on their hands and hands in their pocket, and they would be moving back a little bit. And it was just the way the game was up there. I remember Mike Quadi when he was managing the Cubs. He said it best. He told the Cubs, he goes, "We're going to San Francisco. It's going to be cold. It's going to be windy. It's going to be 2-1.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. So, I mean, but Pablo, he wasn't running very well, especially at the end. And I don't even think, and I said this on MLB Network, and one of the guys went and did all his analytics and came back and said, "You're right." And I go, "Well, how about that?
Yeah, imagine that.
I just watched it." he couldn't go first to third or second to home very often. So I had to... The grounds crew grow the grass out, and I deflated the football.
Oh my God!
I had it. It was a little thicker out there, just so we could get some of these guys around the bases. And the grounds crew got 3 World Series shares.
Those are the you want to talk about winning the margins, winning the inch. You grow out the grass a little bit longer, so that Buster Posey knock checks up a little bit instead of skips right to the center fielder. He checks up on him a little bit, and it slows the ball down. Pablo Sandoval can score one extra run a week, whatever it may be. Those are the inches, the margins. That's the most fascinating stuff for me about the game of baseball. The fact that you had to think about that, thought about that, and then had them execute it was amazing. It's amazing. I love it. We got a couple minutes left before we got to go to break again, but when we come back, I want to talk to you about the art of third base coaching third base.
Absolutely.
And the work that goes into it that, again, the moron layman like myself will just watch the game and go, "Idiot. Oh, why would you send him? He was out by 10 feet." Mm-hmm. The calculations that go into very, very rarely is it willy-nilly. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into it. I want to talk about Tim Leeper. We talked about him. He's the Padres' third base coach.
We've talked about it on the show. Like, when Flan was out there at Fantasy Camp back in January talking to us about how simple it was to coach third base for him.
For him.
the simplicity behind it, it blew our minds.
Well, because he had to dumb it down for dumb ball players after a while.
Like, you're like, oh, MLB player, like players and coaches, they wouldn't use belt for bunt. No, they would.
Flan would, and he had to.
And we had, and look, everybody had video cameras on every third base coach. This thing, of, first of all, about the trash can.
Welcome back, Ben and Woods. 97.3 The Fan, very special guest in studio this morning. The great Tim Flannery joins us, telling all kinds of baseball stories. We will get right back to them after we do a quick check of traffic. All right, joined live in studio by Tim Flannery, former Padre, second baseman, shortstop, utility man. Wherever they needed you, Flann, you would play. You would hit anywhere. You didn't care. Just wanted to be in the lineup every day, which is such a different mentality than guys like I have. Don't hit it here. Do not. Please let me have to sacrifice bunt because I'm afraid to hit. Right? I was always that guy. But no, I mean, some of the guys that you played with, obviously legends of the game. We heard the panel at Fantasy Camp talking about the 84 team, and it was staggering, some of the stories. Goose Gossage, lunatic, straight up lunatic. Gary Templeton.
You're a nerd too.
Yeah, yeah, old Goose telling Ben he's a nerd was amazing.
We made the mistake of putting Goose on live radio.
We did.
Yeah, that and is then a
Ben,
mistake.
It was a huge.
And then Ben started needling him about analytics in today's game.
Oh, I bet he loved that.
He lost it.
That's the drop.
You're a nerd too.
Yeah, called him a nerd. Straight
right
up.
To his face.
Right to his
point
face.
At
pointed
him.
At him.
You're a nerd too.
Yeah, Ben's like, oh, man, I just thought I would. Now I'm a nerd. It's great. It was great.
When they brought Nettles and Goose over right before the season in 1984, we watched them walk in the clubhouse at Jack Murphy, Qualcomm, whatever it's called, was called. And we all looked at each other, and it was such a positive. It was like the front office. They just saved us. This is the time. This
they
is
care.
Our time. And they were such a huge part of, and Nettles being a guy that I loved with New York, he was living in North County. I would drive every day to and back for the ballpark. He would take me with him, him and Goose out on the road at nighttime after games.
Oh,
and,
my God.
I'll never forget. It was like 2:30 in the morning in New York City, and we come up an alley. They're taking me to Studio 54, and we get out, and it's pitch black in the middle of the night, and there's a line, and one guy just said, "Mr. Gossage, Mr. Nettles, come on in."
Unreal.
He taught us. They taught us a lot, and the stories that you were talking about earlier of Peavy and Trevor came to that fantasy camp to be around that crew, be around our 84 crew. And I heard Peavy telling Trevor, "Hoffy, you got to get in here and listen to their stories. These guys, they fought the fans. They were in the stands fighting the fans. They fought other teams. They beat each other up." And then I'd always say, "Yeah, but Goose and I would go to blows sometimes." And then when I'm going out to hit, he'd be there cheering for me, and then we would be out that night. It was just a different time, and thank God there wasn't social media.
Oh, you would have been toast. I mean, I think about it all the time. I think about those old crazy-ass Yankee teams out every single night. That, you know, it's one thing, too. Like, obviously, me as a Padres fan now, there's a part of me that's glad that I don't see my favorite guys out at Studio 54
absolutely.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, because then I'm like, all right. And then, you know, the next day you go 1-for-4, strike out 3 times. It's like, well, no wonder. There's so much information now. Back then, ballplayers were a bit of a mystery, and you could get away with a lot more.
Yes, you sure could. Yeah. And even before that, I hear stories that my uncle told me about Mickey Mantle. He played with Mickey Mantle and during the trains, when they were traveling on trains, you know?
Yeah.
I tell you, we'd talk like the old coaches in San Francisco, because we were the old coaches.
Right.
And WOTUS would go, "I tell you, back in the day when we took the train." So the train's ready to leave, and Mickey shows up right when the train's leaving, about 1-2 in the morning, and he had a couple girls with him, and they said, "Mick, you know the rules. There's no women on these trains." And Mickey goes, "Okay, good luck in Cleveland then."
Oh my God!
And they okay, Mick, come on.
Oh my God! Good luck in Cleveland.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's so good. But if that came out about my favorite player now,
right?
I would hate it. It would be a huge scandal. We'd be wearing it on Twitter and everything else. But oh my God, what a different, what a bygone era. Let's talk about Tony Gwynn, somebody that you played with, and you know, obviously he's one of those guys where every day, if you're on social media or whatever, you always see, whether it's Instagram, whether it's Twitter, doesn't matter where it is, you see some thing pop up, and it's Tony Gwynn's face, and it's Tony Gwynn only struck out 3 times in 14 years or something against this pitcher. And every day, there's this new stat that I see, and I went, it just blows my mind. I know how hard hitting is. I have no idea how hard it is to hit at that level, and against the pitchers that he did it against and the pitchers that you did it against. But my God, did he make it look easy.
He worked at it. He worked at it harder than anybody. And, of course, the story, and it's true that he brought the video in. He brought the first time videos were in. And I'll tell you, to this day, he's probably the only guy that knows what they're looking for when they're looking at the video instead of just staring at it with, you know, glazed over eyes.
Because you're supposed to now.
Yeah. Right. He knew exactly what he was doing. And he, even if he had 4 hits the night before, he had an early hit in every day at 4 o'clock. And it was just, you know, and selfishly, my best year when I got to play every day, I was a utility guy, you know, but when I did play every day a couple of years, I had my best years because I led off and Tony hit second. And when the count would go 1-0, I'd see the manager sprint to the mound. I knew exactly what he was saying. Don't walk this guy. Tony's coming up. So I'd get a pitch to hit. But it, just the way he, and you know, he was my locker mate next to me. And you know that game you've always played before the season against San Diego State, the last game after spring training? Tony, when he was at San Diego State, went 5 for 5 off of our big league pitches.
It's unreal.
And I remember Dick Williams said, that kid over there, I don't know, but I'm just telling you, when he gets to the big leagues, he's never going to be taken out of a lineup ever. And then Tony came up and I had 10 years sitting next to him in a locker, and I turned him on to his bat, his B267, 33 and a half inches, 32 ounces that I used. It was a B267, a nice barrel. And Tony used that his whole career as well.
Here comes this kid. And, you know, you'd seen him a little bit. Obviously, you'd heard about him and knew what he was capable of. And he's your locker mate. You got 10 years in the big leagues. It's very similar to what's going on right now, I think, in the Petco Park. Jackson Merrill, Jerickson Profar did an in-game interview yesterday, which I hate, by the way, in the middle of the inning. And he's great. He did a fantastic job. But he's talking about a 21-year-old coming in, moving guys around defensively. He just started playing center field. And Profar's saying on the interview, now he's moving us, he's positioning us, and he's taking charge. And, bro, this kid's unbelievable. Was that some of the vibe that you got with Tony? Was he a vocal guy when he got there, or was he just kind of quiet?
He was quiet. And
lead by example.
He led by example. He was willing, wanted to learn everything he could learn. But we all, just the way he handled himself as a professional, as a man, it was one of the greatest. To be able to play with him for 10 years and then coach him for another 7. It was 7. We didn't really coach him. I was a coach on the team. Nobody coached Tony.
Tony, get your hands up a little bit more, right?
But it was just remarkable to watch some. And it's like that thing in Cincinnati when I was coaching. I've told the story more than once. I did it on MLB Network.
I saw that. It was amazing. Tell it again.
We were playing the Reds, and we had rain delays all night. And then about 11:45, they brought out a lefty. There was 2 guys on, and who knows what inning it was. They brought in a lefty to face Tony, and then the heavens opened up and just poured. So they suspended the game till the next day, which means you got to play the same lineup. That pitcher hadn't thrown any pitches. He just warmed up. He's got to start the game the next day.
Yep.
So on the way up, now it's like midnight. We'd been there all night with rain delays, and I'm walking with Tony up the stairway in old Cincinnati Riverfront. He goes, Flan, tomorrow this guy's going to throw me a first pitch slider, and I'm going to hit it in that left center field gap, and both runs are going to score. It's going to be 2-2. Be ready. And I, you know, I'm thinking, after we've been there 14 hours as coaches, I go, okay, whatever, Tony. Sure enough, the next day, first pitch slider. He knew what the guy was going to throw him before the guy on the mound knew. And that's what Pete Rose could tell you, and Tony could do the same. He could look at a calendar and say, okay, in 3 weeks, we're playing the Pittsburgh Pirates, and this guy will be starting, and these are the pitches he's going to. They're just geniuses, and they're all in on it.
It's why it makes me insane, because of the comparison. Compare Luis Arraez. He's one of the more similar guys to that. Doesn't make me mad at all, because he does have that ability, you know, bat to ball, good quick hands, can hit the spray the ball. Tony had a little more pop than Luis does. Probably better base runner, but definitely a better defensive player.
Tony made himself a defender.
Yeah, but you watch it. But for me, it's like, well, Tony Gwynn can do it. Tony Gwynn used to do it all the time, and it's like, bro, you got to leave him out of any modern conversations, because there's just nobody that does it like that.
Absolutely. And for as long as he did.
And Nolan Ryan's another one. Nolan Ryan did this. And I'm like, he's a freak. He's a unicorn. He worked his ass off, but he was also one of a billion. You know what I mean?
I faced Nolan Ryan 71 times, more than any pitcher I've ever faced. I faced him 71
times.
You
had success, didn't you?
Enough to be fed to him the next time he pitched. You know, I mean, this guy was... I had some good moments against Nolan, but nobody would play. I could watch... If it was like 2 days before the... There was a catcher up in San Francisco, and Timmy Lincecum comes throwing a bullpen, so I kind of got back, and so I wanted to see what Timmy was throwing, yeah, and what it looked like.
You got in there.
And I'm walking away, and the catcher goes, hey, Flan, did you ever face any nasty guys like Timmy? I go, yeah, I faced Nolan Ryan 71 times. He goes, well, how come? I go, well, I played 10 years in the big leagues, and everybody would get sick. They'd get this virus called Ryanitis. And to this day, that kid still thinks that there's a real virus going. He might be,
of course he does.
He's looking for a vaccine for it.
So Ryan's on the bump the next day. All of a sudden, my knee's a little swollen. My back's a little stiff.
It would start if he's pitching on Sunday. On Friday, you'd hear guys coughing. You know, and I knew that this is, I'm a left-handed hitter. I've got to do it. And then when I was leading off, Nolan, my last couple of years, he would get gets the ball, and the game's about to start. He's rubbing the ball, and he walks down, and he's playing like he's checking the grass right by the plate, and he's looking right at you like, you better not bunt. And so after about the third or fourth time he did, I just looked at him. I said, hey, Mr. Ryan, I ain't going to bunt.
I'm not bunting. Speaking of grass, it's not that grass. You told me a story because, obviously being a part of three championship teams with the Giants, and you had some characters. You were just talking about Timmy Lincecum. You had Buster Posey, but one of the biggest characters, literally and figuratively, it was Pablo Sandoval.
Absolutely.
I mean, a guy that could absolutely rake, a portlier fellow, mm-hmm, not really fleet of foot, but could pick it, had a good arm, the whole thing. And you were telling me about that story, what you had the groundskeepers do out in San Francisco.
Well, first of all, the thing I liked about San Francisco, you'd see the best outfielders' arms, and they would be blowing on their hands and hands in their pocket, and they would be moving back a little bit. And it was just the way the game was up there. I remember Mike Quadi, when he was managing the Cubs, he said it best. He told the Cubs, he goes, we're going to San Francisco. It's going to be cold. It's going to be windy. It's going to be 2-1.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. So, I mean, but Pablo, he wasn't running very well, especially at the end. And I don't even think, and I said this on MLB Network, and one of the guys went and did all his analytics and came back and said, you're right. And I go, well, how about that?
Yeah, imagine that.
I just watched it. he couldn't go first to third or second to home very often. So I had to... The grounds crew grow the grass out, and I deflated the football.
Oh my God!
I had it. It was a little thicker out there, just so we could get some of these guys around the bases. And the grounds crew got 3 World Series shares.
Those are the you want to talk about winning the margins, winning the inch. You grow out the grass a little bit longer, so that Buster Posey knock checks up a little bit instead of skips right to the center fielder. He checks up on him a little bit, and it slows the ball down. Pablo Sandoval can score one extra run a week, whatever it may be. Those are the inches, the margins. That's the most fascinating stuff for me about the game of baseball. The fact that you had to think about that, thought about that, and then had them execute it was amazing. It's amazing. I love this. We got a couple minutes left before we got to go to break again, but when we come back, I want to talk to you about the art of third base coaching third base.
Absolutely.
And the work that goes into it that, again, the moron layman like myself will just watch the game and go, idiot! Oh, why would you send him? He was out by 10 feet. Mm-hmm. The calculations that go into very, very rarely is it willy-nilly. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into it. I want to talk about Tim Leeper. We talked about him. He's the Padres' third base coach.
We've talked about it on the show. Like, when Flan was out there at Fantasy Camp back in January talking to us about how simple it was to coach third base for him.
For him.
The simplicity behind it, it blew our minds.
Well, because he had to dumb it down for dumb ball players after a while.
Like, you're like, oh, MLB player, like players and coaches, they wouldn't use belt for bunt. No, they would.
Flan would, and he had to.
And we had, everybody had video cameras on every third base coach. This thing, first of all, about the trash can. Look, if the hitter can hear somebody banging on a trash can, the catcher probably can hear it. A coach should hear it.
They finally caught on.
Yeah, but it's like, you've got to just, we always knew that. Look, when Glenn Hoffman was down here coaching third, and I love the Hoffmans. I grew up with them.
They're the best.
My wife of 43 years dated Glenn on Fridays in high school and me on Saturdays. We went to different high schools.
That's my favorite.
And then when he became a number one pick, he got his bat contract. You know, I found that bat in Donna's
closet. Hold this. Hold this story. Stay right here. We got to go to break.
I'm talking till 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
It's fine.
Today.
Absolutely fine. These dumb breaks we have to do. We'll be right back. So sorry. Be right back. Ben and Woods, 97.3 The Fan.